And now here it is, the final South by Southwest recap, a full week or maybe even longer. I'm not even sure
anymore. How are we not done with this yet?
Because we all pretty much suffered from like what happens immediately after South by Southwest.
No, it's because South by never ends. It never ends.
That's true.
What if we all died during South by and it's just, it always seems like it's over, but it's never over.
Why you guys shy Milan this? Don't shy Milan this. Don't do it.
I'm just saying, it's a possibility.
Does that mean we get free beer forever?
Okay, I'd be okay with that twist.
Yeah, but then every day is that day when you had too much free beer the night before, and you feel like shit, but then there's free beer again, you're like, oh, but it's free. I know I shouldn't, because I'll be even worse tomorrow.
It's like Groundhog Day, except for alcoholics.
Pretty much.
Anyway.
So it's St. Patrick's Day, I guess.
Welcome to Infestation Part... for South by Southwest. We're going to hear with a bunch of the gang talking about the roundup, the final
wrapping this sucker up.
I am, of course, Chris Cox.
I am Brian.
And joining us are from our regular digital noise fill-in guy, and hopefully soon to be on more of our reviews in general, the great, the legendary Richard Whitaker.
Hey, yo.
You write in those written type papers.
I use Word Pretty. Yes, I am with the Austin Chronicle.
Which actually prints on paper.
Paper.
So do you have a machine that, like, does it, like, from where you speak?
We have elves.
Oh. Wow. That's kind of hot.
Wait, actually. Hold the phone. You're not an elf? No,
the tiny, like, bitey, like, hellboy kind. Not the, you know, diaphanous ones.
Not the kind you would actually... Yes. Anyway, Martin Thomas will be along here shortly, too. He's running a little late, but we had to go ahead and get this sucker started. You know what?
Because otherwise it really would never end.
It really would. So since this thing exists, let's go ahead and talk about the film Exists.
Hey.
The latest horror film directed by Eduardo Sanchez. If you don't know who that is, you must not watch a lot of horror, because he's the guy who, of course, launched the most irritating trend in horror ever with the Blair Witch Project. That admittedly has had some good films come out of it. But he's come along. Long way and has tried a lot of different stuff, and this latest film is about hunting for Bigfoot.
Yeah, what I've found about Eduardo Sanchez is every single one of his movies is about being scared of the woods. Every single one of them. Blair Witch Project, Altered, Lovely Molly, these are all movies that are about stay out of the fucking woods for one reason or another.
The guy's got a serious case of arborophobia.
He does, okay. And in this case it's stay out of the fucking woods because of Bigfoot, and Bigfoot appears to be making a comeback, and I don't mean, like, don't go out with your cameras and think you can actually track him. What I mean is that there's several movies kind of in the works or have been released about Bigfoot. Like, Bobcat Goldthwait had a found footage movie about Bigfoot, for
really?
Fuck's sake. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Animal Planet will have a Bigfoot is real show on.
No, I'm sure History Channel will, because that is apparently what history means to them.
Oh, no, you mean you're telling me you haven't seen $10 million Bigfoot Challenge?
Oh, no.
Which
no.
is a real show.
Oh, I know.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
It's not the first time that sort of thing has existed, because why not put up that challenge?
Yeah.
No one's ever going to claim the money.
Despite the title of this film, Bigfoot does not actually exist. It is a fictional film. That being said, it is a found footage Bigfoot movie about a group of people who are having a nice weekend, go off in the woods to shoot basically YouTube videos of themselves jumping their dirt bikes over creeks and whatnot. And wouldn't you know it, they venture into the realm of the skunk ape, which is a very particular breed of Bigfoot. It's like the Texas version of
Bigfoot. It's the least popular Bigfoot, I'm thinking.
Yes. Yeah, skunk ape. No one wants to be around skunk ape.
But, it's set in Central Texas. And one of the interesting things that Eduardo does is he uses the Bastrop pine forests, and particularly the destruction there, to imply, you know, a reason why Bigfoot suddenly appears here. That, you know, this feeling that something horrible has happened to this creature. And, it, you know, that's the great thing. He doesn't go, oh, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. There isn't the playing around. You know from right off, this is a bunch of people stuck in the woods with something big and angry that really wants to fuck with them. And that's the fascinating thing, is, like, a lot of it is, why is Bigfoot so angry at them?
Mm-hmm.
And, he did
deforestation.
There's more than that going on. He makes a real character. And part of it is helped by the fact that it is a great Bigfoot suit.
Yes, it is.
Phenomenal. This is all practical. And in fact, I was talking to the producers and they said, we weren't going to do this film unless we could make a Bigfoot we were proud of. And they did the suit first to prove that they could actually make it work. And so, I mean, when the camera is stuck right in its face, you're like, holy shit, I believe, like, this thing is real. It's just phenomenal.
There's probably going to be some wag out there. It's like, that's too real. That they must have actually gotten the actual Bigfoot and shot a horror film.
No, because I have actually met the guy who's in the Bigfoot suit for this movie, and his name is Brian Steele. And he's been in a shit ton of stuff. He was one of the Predators in Predators. He's played pretty much every big monstrous thing you could possibly think of.
Sure, that's what they say.
Right, yeah, no, exactly. Actually, it was fun. I got to be on set for this years ago. They filmed out at Spiderwood, which is not far from where we're sitting right now, and it is just a big, dense forest. And I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed the elements that came together. I don't think it's going to be everybody's cup of tea, and I mean that even in the sense of, like, horror fans. Because if you're fed up with found footage, like, this doesn't do anything new with that subgenre. It doesn't do anything groundbreaking. So I feel like if you're already annoyed by it, you're probably going to have an issue with it just used to capture Bigfoot.
And Martin Thomas is here.
Hey, Martin exists.
Hey, whenever I'm on time, people are late. So I figure, like, oh, I'll give Bo a chance to
get there. You and Bo have a battle going on with that.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I held things up.
Oh, no, no, no.
No, it's all right.
We was just talking Bigfoot.
But, like, ultimately, is this a movie that's worth watching? Is it a good found footage film?
Yeah.
Well, it's, I think what makes it, I think the characters are kind of the weakest part, because they are very much kind of sort of one-dimensional college douchebags. But I think when you actually get the scenes of Bigfoot just ripping places apart and chucking entire pieces of equipment at people, you start to forget about the douchiness of the characters, and you just start thinking, I'm kind of terrified that Bigfoot's going to rip my head off.
Okay, nobody told me that.
Yeah.
Because I thought about this movie, and all I was told was like, oh, it's another found footage. When are they going to stop doing that? And I was like, oh, well, I guess it's another one that didn't work. You make it sound cool.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you're already fed up with found footage, I don't think that element's going to attract you. But I really do think they've done a great job with the mayhem and just kind of the frenzied fury of Bigfoot in this film. Like, I was terrified, not necessarily for the people in the movie, but I was just like, I don't want to be this close to this thing. Like, I want to keep a distance.
See, the cutoff point now for found footage, whether or not you're one of those people who's going to ever like it or not, if you catch yourself still going, come on, why would you still be pointing the camera at stuff and holding it? Then you're never going to watch. You just don't watch any of them.
Yeah.
You're right, because that's the same as like, oh, yeah, if you got superpowers, why would you put tights on and fight crime? It's like, look, you got to accept
this part is of suspension this. Of disbelief, and that's got to be the
well,
thing.
Well, I will also say that Sanchez does do a very good explanation of why the camera is always on. And when you have a character who is deliberately trying to get footage of a Bigfoot, that's, you know, of course he's never going to turn off. And I think that's why it works. I mean, a lot of time it's like, yeah, why the fuck wouldn't you?
Well, he uses GoPro a lot, too, where it's like, the camera's attached to you, you can't put it down.
Did you see that Superman GoPro film the guy did?
Yeah, that was good.
I still can't figure out how he did it.
Yeah, no, it's really good.
I'll have to show it to you. It's pretty impressive. But you know what? Let's move on to the next title, which is one that Martin and Richard got to see, which is called Frank.
I love that restaurant.
I do, too, because it's got sausage.
Mm.
And, you know, we like sausage for different reasons. So, this one, I did not realize. He's listed on
the I know. That's the thing. Like, even in the guide, in the Chronicle guide, I mean, South by Southwest guide, it tells you that, which is the thing that made me go see it, but they don't show you in the film to near the
end.
Well,
I tell you what, don't say it again, because we'll just bleep out Chris saying it the first time, and then people won't know who you're talking about.
But then I have to do that.
Oh my God, just bleep it out!
Now, this is when I'm going to be really interested, because this is going to be a film where I think there's going to be a real cultural difference between how Americans see this film and how British people see this film. So I'm really interested to see what you thought about it. And I'll explain why it's going to be weird in a second, but I really want to like hear what you thought of it.
People taking tea a lot in this movie?
Quiet, you.
Nice. I came into this film. I saw it almost by accident. I wanted to go see something else, but this was closer to where I was. And I was like, well, it's on my list of things to see, and I want to check out. It's got an interesting premise. An avant-garde band whose lead singer wears a giant plastic head.
Okay.
And never takes it off.
Kind of looks like Davey from Davey and Goliath.
Yeah, and it's mic'd. And I know it's based on some other, you know, real avant-garde bands.
Dead Mouse, maybe?
Or I don't know. Residents or what have you.
No, it is based on a guy called Frank Sidebottom. And the hat looks exactly like Frank's head. And he was this guy in the 80s and 90s, and he was like a real cult figure in the UK. He was a massive soccer fan. And there's actually a throwaway line where he goes, no ukuleles. Well, the actual Frank Sidebottom played ukuleles all the time. And he was this kind of really weird cult figure. But they make him American, which is kind of a weird thing if you know Frank Sidebottom. So the British audience is kind of going, okay, why not just do a different head? Why keep that? Why keep him called Frank? It reminded me of the horrible, horrible Keanu Reeves version of Hellblazer, Constantine,
yeah, right.
Where the only thing it had in common with the comics was the fact the character was called Constantine.
Oh, like, and he had a trench coat.
Change the color of the trench coat. Nobody's going to go, it's a bad Hellblazer adaptation. So it's kind of got this really weird thing hanging over it for the British audience where they're going, well, why didn't you just do Frank Sidebottom? Or why not change those last couple of things so we're not all looking at it going, fucking Frank Sidebottom?
Well, what's
weird thing to have that change.
What's the story here? I mean, it's a guy who's got a big fake mask on all the time. He's the lead singer of a band.
He's actually not really the main character. The main character is the kid from About Time. That was when it came out last year, right?
The time travel
movie. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's a wannabe songwriter, and when he wants to get off the ground, he can't really. And this band, it comes in where he's standing by, and the drummer, I believe it was, is trying to commit suicide by drowning himself.
Yep.
Keyboard player. And he's just talking to the manager, played by Scoots McNairy. And
who is, as we've established, in every single movie that ever comes
out. And no one knows what he looks like.
Right. And you'll never recognize
him. Yeah, matter of fact, there's other movies I've seen him in where I didn't find out until later that was him. I was like, oh, that was him. Damn. Yeah.
He's like mid-90s Gary Oldman.
Pretty much.
Right, right. Well, he's just talking to him. He's like, well, I play keyboards. And the manager looks at him like, oh, great. I thought I was talking to a real person, and now you this. And he's like, no, I didn't mean it that way. He goes to the van, comes back. He's like, all right, we're playing a gig tonight. Show up. So suddenly, this kid, he's on tour with this band that he loves, you know, dream come true, more of a nightmare come true, because everybody in it is quite out there. Matter of fact, except for when the never taken off the giant plastic head, Frank is the most normal one in the band. And he's very charismatic. He's weird. He makes people do martial arts, and they run around in a cabin. And this kid, they're like, yeah, we're going to stay out here for months. He's like, I'm actually supposed to be back at work on Monday. And it's like, no, you're not. But they go through a bunch of different things, that's all coming to them trying to come to South by Southwest and play there for their big show.
Yeah.
And things just kind of fall apart. There's so much about it that I don't want to say, but yeah. You spend the whole time.
I'm intrigued, yeah.
Maggie Gyllenhaal's in this too, right?
The best thing about it, I mean, there's a lot of great things about it, but the best thing is Scoot McNairy, who is so good in this, and he gives this role as this guy who realizes he is mediocre and that Frank is a genius and that the best thing he can do is enable, but stay out of the way. But there's this real pain and pathos to his performance. It's, you know, he's phenomenal in this. I think he's by far the best part of it.
So I'm getting the impression that you didn't care for it.
I just have these very contradictory feelings about it. I liked it a lot more than I thought I was going to, but I admit a lot of it is the baggage I bought because I'm kind of looking at it going, this is weird. Why are you making like these changes and keeping these bits? But as an overall narrative and as kind of a morality play about, you know, how genius is a lot about circumstance and accident.
Mm-hmm.
And, that battle between genius and mediocrity and the, you know, how being really creative can be incredibly damaging. It has a lot to say about that. And not all of it is obvious or apparent. I mean, I kind of want to see it again to just kind of get those parts because it's really about emotional damage.
It's funny because while this wasn't my favorite film at South By, it is the one I most want to watch again. And I hope that whoever sees this, that somehow the box doesn't reveal who the actor is playing Frank, because, you know, it just kept waiting to get to that. And there was a point where I was like, I bet they're not going to show him. They're not. And then they do. And from the angle they showed him at, I didn't even recognize him at first. I was like, who is? And then finally, like, oh, and he's got a great singing voice. He's like, wow, this guy can do everything.
Yeah, triple threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I actually want to see this. It sounds
Yeah.
Matter
of fact, I thought about you the whole time I was watching it. I was like, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure Chris would like this.
It was on my list. I just, you never managed to see everything on your list. It's
Alpha. Oh, cool. Oh, shit. Just, man. No, the two biggest things on the top of my list, I missed every time.
What are you going to do? Well, you know what? One of the movies that was on my list I got to see, and we, in fact, I think we all saw, I was really grateful to be able to because it ended up being one of my favorite movies of the fest, was The Guest.
Yes!
Yay!
This actually might be my favorite movie. I loved it!
This is directed by Adam Wingard,
Yay!
Who, of course, we've seen quite a few of his films along the way, including the You're Next.
And No Horrible Ways to
Die. And written by Simon Barrett, who also wrote both of those with them. And we actually did an interview with Simon that'll be coming up on the site very shortly as well. That was a lot of fun. But this is a very different movie for both of them, and there's a lot of surprises and how much just plain fun this movie really is. It kind of starts from the premise of, at least the tone of The Stepfather, if you've ever seen that.
Very much so.
John Locke film. I'm going to call him John.
Terry O'Quinn, yes. It's his actual name.
No, it's not, Brian.
J.J. Abrams named him John Locke. I'm going to call him John
Exactly.
I think we don't deify our heroes or anything.
but in this particular one, it's a family kind of in the middle of nowhere who, you know, a little small town.
Haddonfield, Illinois.
Yeah, might as well be.
Might as well be Haddonfield, Illinois.
who get a knock on their door, and it's this young guy who goes, look, I was in Afghanistan with your son, who we've already seen has died.
Well, sorry, I mean to step on you. It's just like, when you open in on this family who's broken because the older son has died.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, I promised him I would come here and basically tell you guys about how much, you know, in the end, how much he loved you and missed you and was sad. And, you know, I mean, it was one of those, it was exactly what they needed, quite frankly, to hear at that point.
Yeah.
So they welcome him into their home with open arms. Of course, if you go back to the beginning of this, you remember where I referenced The Stepfather. So what that means is all is not as it seems. And even though he's about the most charming psycho we've seen in some time, he's still a psycho.
Totally looks like he could have played Captain America if Chris Evans hadn't stepped up.
Yeah, and this guy I have a feeling we're going to be seeing more of.
I couldn't believe how seemingly out of nowhere, like apparently he's on Downton Abbey, but as I am not a follower of Downton Abbey, I did not recognize him. And I haven't seen him.
Just because I'm English, don't look at me.
I figured I'd at least get props from you for not saying Downtown Abbey, but that's fine. Whatever.
I was going to say, I still do that. I don't care. Like, it's Downtown Abbey.
He's just American. So much charisma. Like, the camera loves this dude.
Dan Stevens.
Yeah, Dan Stevens. And he knows exactly how to carry a scene, oftentimes without saying a word. Like, there are a lot of scenes where he's just sitting, and it's creepy because you can tell something's going on with him because he's almost like Stepford Wife about it. Like, he's just sitting and staring, and it's like, what's going on? And then of course the music kind of swells around him, and he's just sitting and looking, and you're still like, I don't feel comfortable right now.
Well, he has a very disarming smile. I mean, he looks he has that like robotic psycho look, and just when you go like
he turns on the charm.
Yeah, he turns on the charm. You're like, well, maybe this guy's okay. I mean, he's beating up the bullies, and he's helping the family out.
Because you're rooting for him not to turn into a complete psycho.
Yeah.
You know he is.
Maybe we can change him.
Oh, my God.
You guys are such women.
It's kind of like a Drive's evil twin in a lot of ways. You got this really, and let's face facts, he is a beautiful man.
Yeah.
Much in the way as Ryan Gosling in.
Sure.
And just does horrible things. When the wheels come off, it comes off so gloriously. And Adam just grabs hold of it and goes, you know what? The final act, not even the final act, like halfway through, he just goes, kids, it's getting nutty in here.
It's very true.
Adam's a very controlled director. He's got a very specific way of doing stuff. Nobody hates the term, but mumblegore. And he pulls together this completely nutso third act, 80s action adventure.
Completely.
Film. Just brilliant. Kind of like, it reminded me of Cobra, which is one of my favorite stupid Sylvester Stallone movies, because it's just like, it gets silly and gross.
Well, it seems like it was like three or four different 80s movies all stitched together, but in a way that just flowed. I feel like I should be watching this on VHS, the whole feel of it. Once again, talk about a guy who's ubiquitous. Lance Riddick again. It's like, that guy's on every time I turn on my TV.
Yeah, he had, in fact, several of the cast members of this were also in the next film we'll talk about, but I'll bring that up then. Yeah, I love Lance Reddick. But I constantly want to buy the guy some Visine.
Like, no, right?
Seriously, dude. You're like the black Marty Feldman or something. I don't know what's going on.
And I feel like as small scale as this movie is, it's Simon and Adam's most, this is going to sound weird to say, but it's their most studio looking film.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's
slick.
It's very slick. Yeah, absolutely. It's slick. And not only that, but we tend to have so much nostalgia for the '80s that we, and I don't just mean us in the room. I mean like filmmakers will fetishize it. And I feel like the way that this movie calls back to '80s stuff is so naturally woven into the DNA of the narrative that it never gets in the way. No. Like it's never like
it never feels
ostentatious.
Gratuitous.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And the way, as you said, that third act, and it builds to basically the most expensive high school themed dance of all time. Yeah. For Halloween.
Since Rushmore.
Yeah, since Rushmore. You're like, how much money does this tiny little town have for their high school Halloween dance?
Definitely.
Holy shit.
And it will repay multiple rewatchings just for that to see how many little references to other moments. They even fit in Enter the Dragon reference. Which
oh,
I was
yeah.
Like,
I know.
How the hell did you do this with some old macrame place mattings and a couple of hay bales? This is awesome.
And I think they're also now trying to establish a Wingard verse because there are references to Your Next.
Yeah.
Really subtle ones. There's a really obvious one and then one that's so subtle that I didn't even catch it until actually AJ Bowen, who has a small role in the film, was like, did you catch so and so? And I was like, no. And he told me, I was like, holy fucking shit, they're building a universe within these movies now.
The last thing I would say is that I'm super shocked because I didn't like Your Next at all. And finding out that these are those guys before I started, I was like, oh no, this is going to be terrible. And I loved it.
It was funny. Brian introduced me a while back to AJ Bowen, who I was grateful for because he is like the sweetest, funniest guy. He's so nice. When I was in line for like first day I was there, line for a movie, he comes up walking up, you know, by the sidewalk, comes up and goes, hey, Chris, gives me a big hug and walks on. And the girl next to me is like, you know AJ Bowen. It's like, trust me, once you shook his hand, you will know AJ Bowen as well as I do. He's a super sweet guy.
And he's one of those guys that will have at least two movies now in every Austin Film Festival from here till the end of time.
Yeah, I think he only is in movies now and is an excuse to come to Austin.
I agree.
He's universally referred to by every filmmaker I ever talked to as the best actor that people don't know yet.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody says he makes decisions when he's performing and you kind of go, I don't know where that came from, but it was brilliant. And he has this ability to read a script and like, even like, this is a tiny, tiny, not even credited cameo when he turns up in this. And I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's not just because it's AJ, but you go, oh God, you can just watch how good and smooth and automatic
I feel like
is.
If I go back now and watch Fringe, I'll see he was an agent on that show the entire time. All right, so our next movie we're talking about is False, which was actually made from the exact same producer as The Guest. So you end up seeing a lot of crossover. They were made kind of at the same time. A lot of the actors, including Lance Reddick, have appearances in this one.
Once again.
But they could not be more different.
No.
This movie stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Oh, I love her so much.
Oh,
she's
yeah,
so
I wanted
awesome.
To see this.
And it's actually directed by her husband, Riley Stearns. One of those things, he's just kind of a very small director. They met when she was 18, fell instantly in love, and are just the cutest couple ever, apparently. But in this, she is a girl who's been in a cult, or I guess she's a woman now. Still, she has girlish qualities.
Well, there is that whole thing about, you know, her parents' role in this, that they hire Leland Orser as this failed cult expert to get her out of the cult, and there's a very ineptly handled kidnapping to try and get her into a motel room, and this is where things get extremely strange and psychologically complex.
And you know Leland Orser from, well, for instance, The Guest, he was the dad, but to me he's always the guy in Seven who's like, he told me to fuck her, and I did! I fucked her! You'll always be the guy with the giant knife dildo.
Is that why you refused to shake his hand during the festival?
It was creepy, dude. Right. I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't shake your hand, you fucked her. That's just gross, dude. You should have taken your own life. Yeah, he plays such a loser in this. Like, this guy used to be the king of, like, deprogramming, but it's that point in time where it's sort of fallen out of vogue. People are starting to sue people who do deprogramming. Oh, you remember when this all came down like that? It's like, hey, this is as bad as the cults are in some ways. And, you know, there's people, AJ Bowen, once again, has a very brief cameo where he comes in, punches him in the face, and goes, thanks a lot for fucking up my family, dick.
Oh, wow. takes off.
But, you know, he's out of money. He's out of time. He owes money to John Grease, who plays this very gay. I don't know what it was. He's a photographer or something.
Sold me on this movie when you said the words John Grease.
Lance Reddick works for him as like his enforcer who's trying to get the money from him. But when he gets this, he's being harassed by this older couple saying, you know, we really want you to, you know, you've got to help our daughter. He's finally like, I don't have any money. Fuck it. I don't care anymore, but I'm going to do this. But yeah, boy, does it get weird as the tables start to turn and she starts being the one who's deprogramming him.
Yeah.
And this is not one of those cutesy little, like, oh, isn't that funny the way it all works? No, no, this isn't cute at all. This is actually turns quite horrifying as it goes along as you watch the way she tendrils her way into his brain with her own smarts and with one hell of a fun little twist ending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I did not see how bleak it was going to get. And that final act, you know, people, it's very rare anybody tries to pull off something that horrific and it doesn't get, and it's not bloody,
yeah,
but it takes an extremely dark psychological turn towards the end. And you know, it comes down to how well Leland also carries it, and he is phenomenal at this. This was for my money the standout performance of the entire festival.
Wow. Because a lot of people said that.
I really was just sat there going, because he plays a good guy. This, you know, this is a man who is down on his luck, has failed at every point, but every failure has been from the best of intentions. He's never done it, you know, even when he's stealing hotel rooms and faking his way to getting a free breakfast and trying to shill his latest book. You feel that there's something, you know, weirdly honourable underneath all that, that he's, you know, he's fucked up for the best reasons. And that's, you know, he does that so well. That sense of damaged pride.
Yeah.
But
vulnerability.
Yeah. And it, you know, he can't read people. And that's, you know, that's his downfall. And when that third act comes, it is just it's a hammer blow and it stuck with me for days.
Really, oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, when you know what's the third time they're in the bathroom, watch out.
Yeah.
It's funny. The most powerful scenes in this film take place in a bathroom, strangely enough. But yeah, it's all basically, the majority of it is in this one hotel room.
Yeah.
And they manage to get a lot done in one room.
Oh, I love films like that.
Yeah, it's a nice little bottle film that really does work. Now, the next one we're going to talk about is The Infinite Man, which is one of the ones I really, really am mad I didn't get to see because it's a time travel movie, and I love time travel movies. But I believe Martin and Richard got to see this one.
Yep.
I'm surprised we weren't sitting together.
Sharing a popcorn.
Okay, so Richard, so now you, what did you think about this movie?
I really liked it. It's down in the Antipodes, the other side of the world. And this guy basically is an amiable loser scientist who keeps trying to recreate the perfect date with his girlfriend. And you can never do that, obviously.
No.
So he decides to cheat. By, first of all, she thinks, it puts this device on her head and she thinks, oh, he's managed to capture our memories and he's replaying this. No, it's a time machine. It's an amateur knight's time machine.
She should have known.
And he is, you know, trying to get that relationship absolutely perfect every single time for the one way that he could. And it's about kind of not being able to adapt to circumstances, particularly when he starts bumping into past and future versions of himself who either have no clue what's going on or are very confused or know everything that's gone on. And we're able to say, no, you need to stop now and get out of the way so I can do what I need to do.
Right.
And there's a lot of him punching himself in the face.
he gets hurt a lot.
Yeah.
By himself, presumably.
Yeah. I mean, technically
it's Tyler Durden doing it.
I mean, even though Groundhog's Day wasn't time travel per se, it's sort of like, it's like that, but it's like, well, it also could have gone this way.
So it's like the end of Clue.
If all the characters were in the room when they came in to solve it already, we're like, wait, what's happening?
Well, and there's so many, like, I mean, I didn't catch the name of anybody because, well, they're all Australian. And I was like, I may never see them again. But, But but the lead guy, he gives such a great nuanced performance, because as it goes on, you get to see all these little personality tics of his. Like, at first it's like, yeah, he's a little nerdy guy who wants to have this perfect weekend with his girlfriend. And the first thing is that he gets her out there from what they did a year ago, and the place is abandoned. Like, it's been shut down. So he's already missed that. But he's still trying to go like, okay, well, he has a schedule written down. We're going to do this at this time. And at 6:15, I'm going to sing to you. And I wrote a song in Dutch to celebrate your heritage. And she's just kind of like, we don't have to do it like that. And then some brutish Greek guy who's had a thing for her shows up and really throws a whole big monkey wrench in his plan. So it's kind of like the nerd versus the jock, and everything's going wrong. But yeah, he's got the time machine. It keeps coming back. And you think you're going to see a progression of it getting better. And sometimes it feels like, okay, he's starting to figure it out. And it's like, no, now you just set up a whole new set of problems. It's funny. It's sweet. It's got a good message in it. It's a great date movie, actually.
And it's another sealed bottle movie, because it's basically him, his girlfriend, Alex Dimitrades as this complete asshole,
yeah,
javelin, competitive javelin guy, who still carries his javelin around. And I read about reason, apart from the fact that, like, his ego is still so tied up with it. And that, yeah, there's kind of this clever, pun-riddled dynamic between the main guy and his girlfriend. And then this guy's just wandering through, like, this kind of huge buffoon, and it's hilarious.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. The humor's not too broad. It all works really well. And just the puzzle of it. You know, so often with time travel movies, I think that there's a point where I'm like, if I'm following this correctly, you're cheating. You're doing something that's not working
out. There's always that point, as a time travel movie aficionado, I watch them with a very critical eye, going like, all right, there's always a point where you're like, no, that's where you fucked it up. That's where you fucking, you gotta do something that complex. You gotta be, nowadays, or you gotta be more careful than that. We talked about one earlier, Predestination, that I got to see, I was shocked by the end of it. I was like, wow. You somehow managed to tie all those threads back together. So this is one you feel like that they did that way?
Yeah. Yeah. There was never that point where I went, oh, hold on a second. When I follow the thread back, that doesn't work. I was like, no, this all works pretty well.
I actually asked the writer-director, Hugh Sullivan, about this. And he said, yeah, there's two ways you can do a time travel film. You can either, you know, go the primer path, map everything out, really be as precise as you can, hope you don't create any temporal anomalies and the universe collapses. Or you can do Back to the Future, where you know the science doesn't work, but you understand emotionally what it is. Yeah. And he went, you know, having spent months laboring over the script and putting, like, different timelines in different fonts and different colors and making sure everything worked, I really wish I'd done the Back to the Future one, because it's a lot simpler and you cry less. It's really incredibly neat. And you know, the central actor, Josh McConville, you know, he does three different versions of himself so well, because he's the only one who's really aware of everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And he's having to, like, throw himself around and work out what he was doing. And he really, he pulls it together, because he knows where he is in any one scene. So you can kind of go, oh, right, I trust him to take me through whatever nonsense is going on. And I think it's going to, like, something like Primer, it's going to stand up to multiple watchings, just to solely go, oh, hang on, I'll watch it for what's happening to this timeline guy, and then I'll watch it for this time. So it actually, it's got some,
yeah, it really does. And even, like, some of his other, you know, future versions, you go like, okay, well, this one, he's got it together. He knows what's going on. But the more you watch him, you're like, no.
None of these guys have it on.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Multiplicity, but if instead of getting stupider, the variant versions get meaner.
Right.
Well, you get more frustrated the more you do it.
Oh, yeah.
So it's stressful time travel.
Like, imagine visiting yourself from 5 years ago.
Oh, fuck that guy.
What an asshole he was.
No fucking way.
Well, you know what? I know you have to leave soon, but yep. I do want to hear about some of the movies real quick that I was so mad I didn't get to see that you got to see. One of which is What We Do in the Shadows.
I
want to
see that too.
Which everybody was raving about.
Hilarious. It is a mockumentary about vampires. Don't run. It's actually good. It's from New Zealand. It's got one of the guys from Flight of the Conchords.
Jermaine Clement.
Jermaine.
Yeah. I say Jermaine and I always hear Jackson.
There's no R in his
name. Is Jermaine to the point.
It's about these four vampires who share a house in the suburbs of a New Zealand city. And they're kind of all the archetypes. There's the faintly foppish 18th century one who's pining for his lost love. And then there's the Vlad the Impaler one who thinks he's so cool. And there's this great line where he goes, you know, you look the age you were when you died, and I was only 16 when I became a vampire. And he looks like 40-something, and he went, yeah, the Middle Ages were really tough. And then there's the early 20th century one who's like, I just like killing people because it's cool. And then there's the one downstairs who's like the fully fledged Nosferatu one who just appears and goes, and runs off. But underlying it is the fact that there's these four guys, all of whom are hopeless losers. Did I look around this room then? I just feel bad about myself.
Yeah, except we're not immortal and beautiful, so yeah. I don't know.
Well, neither were they. That's the whole thing. They're all kind of vaguely rubbish, and they're sharing a house in the suburbs. But, you know, they kind of go to nightclubs and pick up victims. But it's really, they have to keep going to the same one because they know this one bouncer who will invite them in. So the other ones, they go, there's this great scene where they go to the club and go, can you invite us in? And the bouncers go, fuck off. No. And they've got to go away. And it's very, very funny. And then suddenly it'll just kick into these action sequences where they're chasing one of their prey. And it's really funny and really well done. And then boo, it's like, it has that kind of handheld feel,
yeah,
but it's really convincing. And there's also a great subplot about how they keep getting into fights with the local werewolves as well, who are equally rubbish.
Man,
and,
this movie sounds
all
incredible.
Wear, all wear anoraks, because, you know, when you're not furry, you get cold.
Yeah, everybody I talked to who saw this came out of it going, this sounded like it was not going to be that great, but I don't remember the last time I saw a film this funny.
Damn.
I heard that repeatedly.
Yeah, and again, this was one of these things that I walked into. I was supposed to go and see something at the Paramount, and I'm like, they went, no, we're full, you gotta go somewhere else. And I just go, oh, I'll walk to Stateside. And it was hilarious.
How in the blue fuck is the Paramount ever full? That's what I want to know. It's South by Southwest.
That 90-year-old with blue rinse. I don't know. It was a really weird moment.
It must have been one of the big red carpet movies.
I think it was. But yeah, this is, you know.
It uncomfortably seats like 2,000 people. So.
Ah, scoliosis central.
Now, the other film you got to see that I heard great things about was Housebound.
Another New Zealand one. Kind of semi-regular institution in Austin, producer Ant Timpson, who is regularly hanging around the
crowd. Ant Timpson.
Yes. I haven't got drunk with him yet, and I feel like I've missed out on something.
I don't remember if I've been drunk. That's how good a drunk he is.
But I will say, it starts off with a bank raid, and they're trying, this couple like runs out of a car, and is trying to break into one of the auto tellers outside. And you think, oh, this is going to be a really gritty crime thing. And then a minute in, it has one of the best stupid sight gags I have ever seen. And I almost fell out of my chair laughing. I was watching a screener at home, and I had to stop because I was laughing so much because it was so stupid and brilliant. And I'm like, this is excellent. And from that moment, totally hooked. The female character who's involved in the robbery, the courts go to give her the worst punishment they possibly can because they didn't really do anything because they're that incompetent. So they put her under house arrest with her parents, yeah, who are terribly nice, and she's all like rebellious and young. And she can't go more than 200 feet from the house, which is just killing her because she hates her parents and became a criminal to get away from them and to annoy them. But
as you
the
do.
Other shoe that drops is she can't leave the house and there seems to be a ghost, which was done. The same thing was done really horribly.
100 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a total piece of crap. This is really funny and scary.
Yeah, it's got some legitimately creepy moments in it.
Yeah.
Like some of the things that happen, especially in the basement.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, fuck this. I'm getting out of this house. I'm not even in this house. I'm getting out of this house.
And it has this. It's kind of like we were talking like with Exist, where you go, okay, we're just going to put the monster out front and center. She has this moment where she goes to her mother and her probation officer and goes, I think there's a ghost. And she's convinced they're going to say she's completely nutty. And this is really on in the proceedings, so I'm not spoiling anything. And they go, oh, yeah, let's go get the cameras. And they automatically, in this kind of Ghost Hunters International mindset, where like you try and find ghosts. It's just the thing you do. It's like, oh, let's go looking. And she's like, no, this is insanely dangerous. This thing seems to be trying to kill me. And they're like, nope. We've got, let's do some audio recording. See if it will communicate from beyond the grave. And she's stuck with a ghost and idiots. And it's this portrait of frustration where she just keeps rolling her eyes and just going, I hate you. Yeah. So, and it's Morgana O'Reilly, who plays the woman who's stuck at home, and she's really good. She just has this look of like, I will kill all of you.
Perpetually frustrated with anyone and everyone.
Yeah, and it's again, like what we do in Shadows, it's that kind of New Zealand splat stick, slightly, you know, not totally over the top Peter Jackson, early Peter Jackson style, but that kind of like, you know, big, broad comedy with some real smarts about it. And I really love this little film. And yeah. I think it's got distribution. If it has, I will be ecstatic because it really deserves it.
This is another one I'm definitely really looking forward to. I just want to see everything from New Zealand, apparently.
It's on a roll. It was funny. My favorite films this year at South By were the stuff from New Zealand and the two Snoop productions, which was The Guest and Faults. So there's like... Yeah, I joked at the time, if I can get Keith Calder and Ant Timpson to produce a film together, that will be my Battleship Potemkin, and I'll be done.
You know where you can make that happen is a place called Twitter.
Yeah, actually, I did that. I kid you not. I said that on Twitter, and Ant went, I'd love to work with Keith, and Keith went, I'd love to work with you. And I went, well, I'm going to be in LA soon. I'm like, I'm holding you guys to this. I really want this to happen because I just think those guys are doing such fun work at the moment.
I agree.
You know, it's not necessarily highbrow, but it's awesome.
Oh, come on. It's that midbrow where the best stuff gets done anyway.
Yeah, totally.
It's smart enough to hide how smart it is.
Right. Well, thank you, Richard, for joining us.
I appreciate it. Richard! My pleasure. I have to run. There's Chipotle calling me.
Yeah. Take your $20 and go. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, good to see you again.
Finally got that damn sponsor we've been trying to nail down.
All right, well, we're going to keep going, and we have a lot more films to talk about. And let's go ahead and talk about Creep. One of the weirdest horror movies I've seen
in a while. It's a Radiohead movie.
No, it's not. But My Iron Lung is coming out soon, and that is. So. Nice. No, Creep is... God, what a strange concept. Mark Duplass, who, of course, always plays very likable, if not a little smarmy characters, like, for instance, on The League.
Isn't he the king of mumblecore?
He is one of the kings of mumblecore,
but
for
he
sure.
also does a lot of other types of stuff now. Like, Safety Not Guaranteed was, like, a big role for him. And then, of course, like I said, on The League, which is about as far from mumblecore as you can get, that TV series, he's one of the lead characters and writers. But in this movie, he plays a killer, which is really odd casting, and certainly not what, like, it actually is Mark Duplass playing a very Mark Duplass type character.
Yeah.
Who's also completely insane and a killer.
So now, basically,
I'm going to tell you, I'm nervous because the last time something like this happened, it was Owen Wilson in The Minus Man, and that was horrible.
No. This is what's interesting. I really liked, the last time I saw Mark Duplass, he may have, you know, made a couple in between then and now, but the last time I saw him in anything horror related was a movie called Baghead. And I kind of liked Baghead, I guess, more for the story that was going on more than I liked it as a horror film. Hmm. And what I like about this movie is it is exceedingly simple in its construction. It's a guy who finds an ad on Craigslist that is going to pay him a lot of money to just go to this guy's house and film his average day. And it's because this guy has cancer and he wants to basically make a living document for his unborn son because it doesn't look like he's going to live to see him. So it's basically just following him around all day and, you know, I'll pay you, no big deal. Well, the more time he spends with the guy, the more uncomfortable he gets because it seems like
he's one of those guys who wants to hug all the time. He's always like, it's like, have you ever been on a first date when someone says they say they love you before it's even over?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's the best buddy version of that.
Okay.
You know, and then it's sort of what I like about it is you think it's going to all be about the two of them and what that encounter culminates to, but it's actually not only about that encounter, but the aftermath of it as well. And throughout all of it, battling the idea that even though this guy is completely whacked, like, he's the main character still feels a lot of sympathy for him, and kind of the back and forth emotion of, like, I need to get this guy as far away from my life as possible, and man, he's really sad. I really, like, my heart goes out to him. So it's a very complex sort of character that Mark Duplass is playing, and I like that relationship. I like the fact that this guy, who and we don't see very much of because he's behind the camera, it's essentially a found footage type setup.
I just want to stop because you were using a lot of pronouns. Mark Duplass is the cancer guy?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. The guy who has hired the other guy, played by Patrick Bryce, to come and film him. The thing is, the guy who's filming him, I mean, because of the nature of what he's doing, he's interested in people. He's an empathic type person.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's a sweet guy. And he keeps getting struck between the whole, like, God, this poor guy. There's no wonder he's so needy for people and attention in his life. And being really creeped out by the fact that this guy does genuinely really creepy shit.
Yes.
And as it goes on, it really, really starts to snowball to a point where, it does an interesting thing I didn't expect, where it leaves the primary initial situation. He's like, well, I'm getting the fuck out of here and going home. And then things get really weird.
And I liked it a lot. I liked where it ended up going. I liked Mark Duplass a lot in the film. I thought it definitely has that sort of, not totally unscripted, but definitely there's a lot of it that feels very in the moment. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that people latch onto and say, oh, that's mumblecore. And you like that or you don't, that's fine. But, like, I think it really works in this film. And I was really happy with how it ended. And I thought it had just the right amount of jumps. Like, it wasn't a jump scare type movie, but it had just the right, you know, because when at the end of the day, this is a movie in a box. I mean, it's a lot of it takes place just within this one house between these two guys. So, I mean, there's only so much you can do to generate the scares unless you're, you know, making people jump. But I felt like they did a good job of showing restraint, even, you know, even with those circumstances. This is actually a Jason Blum production.
Yeah.
No, it's been picked up for distribution by Blumhouse.
It feels like every other Blum film I saw this year, which there were several, they all feel like if it does well, we could easily make sequels, which is what Jason Blum is very good at doing.
Indeed.
And that's the thing is, like, even though there are jump scares, they're often jump scares that are there, they scare you, but they're also there to make you laugh. And they do that pretty efficiently because it's definitely a comedy horror. You know? I mean, it is genuinely creepy, but it's just so bizarre. Duplass's character, you can't help but laugh.
Yeah, but I don't know that I would really call it a comedy horror because I don't think its intention is to be comedic as much as it's just giving you those few moments of levity to then suck you right back into what's going on. I don't feel that its overall aim is to have a sort of comedic undertone. I just think those moments we laugh because it's really fucking tense up until that point, and it's just nice to have that catharsis, which I think is a real testament to how effective the movie is, that we are laughing, but mostly it's a very nervous laughter. It's like, okay, oh God, what's happening?
Well, the next thing we're talking about is one that you got to see I did not, Among the Living.
Oh, yeah.
Which is one of the ones, very sad to see, because this is written and directed by the folks who did the movie Inside, which
Julia
is
Marie
one of the most
and
frightening, gory horror films I've ever seen. The fucking French, I swear to God.
Yeah. The fucking French. This is by Alexandre Bustillo and Julien Marie. If I'm pronouncing their names incorrectly, I apologize. But the guys who did both Inside and then Livid. I actually don't remember if I've seen it because there was that year at Fantastic Fest kind of runs together. But this film opens with if you can wrap your head around this from these directors, a pregnant woman in peril. Because apparently with these guys, it's extremely tough to be pregnant in horror. There's this really kind of catastrophic event that happens at the beginning of the movie. And then we shift over and we're following a new group of kids. Or a new group of characters that are three kids. And the film really has a sort of Amblin quality to it. Because we're following these kids around as they're just, you know, being crass with each other and sneaking out of detention to go smoke. And we're really just following them. And throughout the whole movie, they are the focus. They are the ones that ultimately have to deal with the supernatural threat, which is a very 80s thing in general. So I really like that about it. And they end up stumbling into, there's a deserted movie studio near their house, which if I was a kid and there was a deserted movie studio
I'd
near my house,
there.
Yeah, I would just move in. But they come across something very nasty going on kind of underground at this movie studio. And that ends up kind of chasing them home, and it's how they deal with it.
They were filming a Serbian film, right?
You're not terribly far off. But anyway, yeah, so it's just about that following them home and them having to deal with the aftermath of that. And it's really kind of sweet in its own way, even though it is really severe and it's a very take no prisoners type of movie. I mean, it is not afraid to kill kids. I'm just going to put it that way. It's a dark, but in that way, it's less Steven Spielberg and more Stephen King.
Sort of Stand by Bazemois.
Exactly. Yes. Stand avec moi. Yeah, absolutely. And I really liked it on that level. And the monster or the main sort of aggressor in this movie is so well designed, just so eerie to look at. And it just, oftentimes it's just standing there until it like rages, and it's got sort of an angry child type rage to it. Like it'll just start pounding its fists and it doesn't like, it's not. Ugh, it's hard to describe.
But it's a clown mask too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is by default the creepiest thing.
Yeah, it's just terribly, terribly unsettling, and it's got beautiful cinematography. And like I said, it's a very sweet story in its own way, and I really enjoyed it. I probably enjoyed it the most of any of their stuff that I've seen.
Oh, wow.
And it does that thing that Livid did well, or that Inside did well, where it sits in the little moments, like it just lets you see something in the background, and then that thing is gone. Like it does this sort of anti-jump scare thing. Like there's that shot in Inside where the woman just kind of appears in the doorway and then vanishes. And it's so frightening because the woman in the room doesn't see it. And you're like, Jesus Christ, get out of the house. And it has so many moments like that throughout this movie. And I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is definitely going to be on my list to catch and soon. And I just want to say, this was coming up recently with someone because they're talking about remaking It again, Stephen King's
right,
It.
Right.
And I've always said Stephen King himself has admitted he's not great at endings.
Right.
He's, if anything, strangely humble about that.
Well, that's good.
But that's the thing about It. I'm like, let Frank Darabont take this one over because that ending, look, a giant spider is not scarier than a clown.
Hold on. A giant spider from space. Thank you very much. Because apparently it's a Roger Corman ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of those. It's like, oh. Well, giant spiders.
If it was a giant spider with clown makeup, it would have been more effective. You do not want to see a six-armed juggler.
That's true. That is true.
Or any juggler. Anyway, one movie I want to ask you about you got to see, Martin, that we did not, and I was really curious about, was Jimmy, All By My Side, which was a slice-of-life biopic of Jimi Hendrix with one of the guys from Outkast.
Yeah, with Andre Benjamin, or a.k.a. Andre
3000,
playing Jimi Hendrix. And it was interesting to see it because it's written by John Ridley, famous for being screenwriter on 12 Years a Slave and Undercover Brother. He's actually the creator of that also. And his I don't know if it's his directorial debut, but he directed it. It's a small production. It's mostly Andre Benjamin as Jimi Hendrix, Imogen Poots as Keith Richards' girlfriend who kind of discovers him, and the other two women who are in his life. Haley Atwell, who becomes his girlfriend, and then my new crush, Ruth Negga, as somebody who sort of comes in and screws things up. I don't know. It's an odd movie in the choices that it, like, the slice of his life it chose to take and focus on.
Would you call her now my Negga?
You can't say that.
What?
Yeah. You can't make that joke.
My last name is Negga. I don't get. Oh, yeah. I see what you're. You're right.
This girl's grown up her whole life with these jokes. I'm sure.
God. Chris says these things because he doesn't have to deal with our angry letter department.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello.
It's all like, dear fuck you guys.
Dear. Yeah. Exactly.
I'm actually surprised to hear. I didn't realize until you saying this just now that this was the Andre 3000 Jimi Hendrix movie. Yeah. I was thinking every time somebody mentioned this in passing, I thought it was an actual documentary. I didn't realize it was sort of a biopic.
I think some documentary either has been made or is in the works.
Yes, you're right.
Which happens so often.
Yeah.
So you get confused about which movie is which.
Sort of the infamous Capote situation where there's two of them going on at once.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I think I kind of had that role in the back of my head also.
Uh-huh.
But then hearing like, oh, it's Andre Benjamin. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, clearly this is a drama. And it's one of these where even though it was signed off on by somebody in the Jimi Hendrix estate, they clearly didn't have the rights to any Jimi Hendrix music. So you don't hear any of the great songs. And it's Andre Benjamin doing all his own music.
So they weren't even allowed to do the covers?
Right.
Oh wow. That sucks.
Yeah. And he's, like, most of his guitar playing is not even an electrical guitar.
Yeah.
It's a lot just on a standard guitar. So you have sort of the effect of, I mean, about as, you know, what you got with Joaquin Phoenix's Johnny Cash, except it's not even those actual songs. But he does a great job. Like, there's no problem with the actors. Andre Benjamin really does look like Jimmy and is able to, you know, imitate his voice mostly. A lot of histrionics from the women. It's just this histrionic period that's most about these fucked up relationships he has. And sort of how he gets started, but it's not even that interesting of a period that was chosen. It's just one of those where I was like,
Of all the times, why did you pick this one?
Yeah.
Do you think maybe that was a conscious choice after they found out that they weren't going to get the music?
That could be.
Because that's the only thing I could think of is, like, if you go into it knowing that you're not going to have rights to the music, you're not going to focus on Woodstock.
Pre the Jimi Hendrix experience?
It's actually, like, it goes from him playing and, you know, just doing session work.
Yeah.
To going over to England. It's before he hits big in America.
Okay, so
it's his time in England.
Right.
Before Are You Experienced actually came out.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It's just that slice. Yeah, and there's so many odd choices in it. And I spent the first half of the movie going like, I so wanted to like this and I feel like it's not letting me. And then I kind of came around to where I think it's not so much that it changed, but I kind of got in the groove of where it was.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I guess I'm kind of with
it. The acid kicked in.
pretty much. And yet, where it cuts off, it was like, yeah, you know, it's a warts and all. I mean, it's not afraid to show him beat up his girlfriend at some point. But I don't know. It never seems to hit those points that make you, like, everything that makes you say, like, oh, I really want to see a Jimi Hendrix movie.
Yeah.
It never quite gets that. One thing that did stand out to me, the actor they get to play Keith Richards, who's only in it for just almost a cameo, looks dead on like a young Keith Richards. It's like they went back in time to get him.
I bet he's thinking about, like, getting plastic surgery or something now, though. He's I got like 10 years left till I start to look like the mummy. And stay that way till for next 300 years.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that has good things about it. I don't know that I can recommend it or tell somebody who wants to see it not to.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it's wow, okay. It's hard to wrap your head around, you know, especially in the idea of a Jimi Hendrix biopic without Jimi Hendrix music.
Just, yeah.
That's baffling to me.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, one of those, they've been very stingy about wanting to, like, who they're going to allow to use his music. And I think there actually is an approved documentary, or not documentary, but movie being made
that
is getting to use his.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I guess they probably only want the one that doesn't show the warts.
Oh, yeah, probably so. And, you know, and it could be this was just hampered by budget, because that's the one thing. It's like so much goes into the costumes and the settings, but it just doesn't, you know, like I said, it's so small in its scope.
Yeah. And this was by John Ridley, who did Undercover Brother.
Yeah.
Or he wrote it anyway.
Well, he created it. I mean, like, Undercover Brother was a web comic long before it was a movie.
Yeah. And of course, 12 Years a Slave, in which case he'll get to do whatever he wants to after this, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. The last thing we're going to talk about is Oculus, which was certainly one of the most talked about movies at the festival. And we're not going to go too deep into this.
Yeah, because this is another screening.
We're actually going to have a full review for this, but I wanted to give a little early look at this since we did get to see this at South By, and we can talk about it in advance. So there. this is the third of the Blumhouse Productions films that came out, and certainly the one I think that they're going to be pushing the hardest.
Oh, sure.
This is getting a wide theatrical release almost immediately. It's got Karen Gillan from Doctor Who, played Amy Pond as the star, who's just gorgeous and charismatic. It's got Katie Sackhoff in it in a role from Battlestar Galactica. It's already got like a geek,
It's got street cred.
Boy, it's stacking the deck here.
But it is,
which will help, because another one of its producers is WWE Studios for some god knows why reason.
Wait, you mean like wrestling?
Yeah.
That's actually becoming more and more common now.
Well, no. I understand that they produce movies.
Yeah.
But they produce movies that have fucking wrestlers in them. And the only other movie I know of that they produce that doesn't have a wrestler in it is The Call with Halle Berry.
That was another weird one.
And that one made no sense to me either, so I don't know.
I think they're just one of those. It's the same way the Animal Planet now does documentaries about mermaids. It's like eventually they're like, we're just going where the money is.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they're doing at this point. But this is interesting because it takes the really overexplored genre of haunted house movies lately, and it actually finds something different to do with it.
Oh,
something
okay.
I've honestly never seen before.
Yeah, no, I haven't either.
The story here takes place years after there was a murder in a house where a mother and father were both killed, and the father was killed by the very young son, who at this point has just gotten out of basically, I guess, juvie. Psychological juvie.
Yeah, it's sort of like a home for psychologically disturbed young people.
Yes. And he, Tim Russell, played by Brenton Thwaites, and his sister picks him up, Karen Gillan, who's immediately like, you know all that shit they told you about, none of that stuff having happened that we told him about there being like this demon in the house that came out of a mirror, ancient mirror that made dad go crazy and did all this shit. You know, they told you that was all in your mind. It wasn't in your mind. It's real. We're going to kill that bitch tonight.
Yeah.
Wow.
She has gone and like found the mirror and basically stolen it and put it back in the old house they grew up in where all the shit went down and set up cameras everywhere and all these different sort of like, you're like, why are the, you know, she like set up various alarms. Like, this is when we know we need to drink water. This is when we know we need to eat. This is when we know we need to do this and that. And you're like, why? Well, because this isn't your average type of ghost thing. This is the sort of ghost that actually changes your perception so drastically that in this mirror's long history of owners, some of the people just died of dehydration because they like had no idea they hadn't drank anything for so long.
It can convince you you're anywhere in any time period. It can convince you of anything. And a lot of times it convinces you to hurt yourself. It's this sort of like mental malady demon. It's not the kind of thing that like jumps out all the time and tries to grab you or stab you. It's making you hurt yourself.
And in as much as there are more ghosty type elements, you certainly get to see, if not the demon in its original form, then it's sort of like glowy eyed versions of people whose souls it's taken throughout the centuries, basically, that the mirror has been around, who come and appear and go, I'm a scary ghost. but I think where this works the most is just that premise of like, wow, there really is, no way of knowing what's real and what's not. But at the same time, that's also what hurts this movie the most, I thought, because there's that point you go, well, how could anybody possibly defeat this thing?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
What possible way is there, even with the things that you brought in there, to think that you could beat this? And I felt like for me, like any horror movie needs a point where you go, they've got a plan. This is how they're going to get out of it toward the beginning of the third act. And I felt like this movie just completely lacked that.
I completely disagree. I mean, her plan from the very beginning is that plan.
No. But that's what I'm saying is they find themselves into a corner and they never find find that route with like, oh shit, well that plan didn't work. We need to find a way to make this work. And it just.
Well, I mean, I think that's more a testament to the power of the entity that's living in the house than it is a mark against, I think. I don't know. I didn't have that problem. I actually thought that was one of the great things about the movie is that, they struggled so hard and her plan was so scientific and that, you know, when things started going wrong, it's like the demon is able to tap into the fear that they had as children and sort of thwart their best efforts, you know, along the way. Even as prepared as she was, the reason that this demon continues to plague them is because it continues to put them in the place they were as children and experience a much higher level of fear than they now have as adults when they're being very pragmatic about it.
Most interesting thing about it is that the film manages to tell its story in two time periods that even though we already know how the earlier time period ended up, it's still they're being thrown back constantly where they themselves are confused and to what happened before as we're seeing in a linear way, flashing back to these events as they're going throughout the house that are sort of interacting in their own way with what's going on in the present day. This is the way the demon is getting to them, basically, and the way the filmmakers are choosing to build up sort of two ghost stories going on at the same time, really.
I really liked that about it. And I also really like the performances of the two leads here. I think that there is this interesting relationship between a girl who is very much at the end of her rope, but being very brave and scientific about it, and a guy who is just shaken off all this shit from his past, only to be immediately thrown back into it, who's so terrified by what happened as a child, he doesn't want to believe that anything is now happening because that's easier to deal with. And I thought, like, even though, you know, the relationship between them, she really loves this guy, but she is continuing to, like, slap him in the face, be like, wake up, like, this is really happening, we need to deal with this. And I don't know. And there are moments in this movie that are just so, so creepy. And they do that thing. And I know I harp on this a lot, but overuse of jump scares is really like one of my pet peeves in horror. And I felt like this is another movie that really knows how to use the little moments, the background scares, the stillness, and do it really well. And this is the first movie since Wreck, where after I watched it, I didn't really want to go to bed right away. Like, I was like, I'm gonna hang out where there's light for a while. I try to convince myself that I'm like hardened to horror movies. Like, I'm jaded. It's fine.
Well, what's the fun in that?
But I'm not at all. And when a good one comes along, it fucking affects me.
That's why I go see so many horror movies. Cause that one out of every 300 or so that you're like, fuck, just lying in bed later that night going like,
like drug addicts looking for that pure strain.
You just
man.
Want that little fix, that little fix. The Exorcist was the biggest one ever, and we know it'll probably never be that scary again.
The Exorcist is our China White. Like, yeah. Nothing's going to be more potent than that.
But even a little taste of what that was like.
Yeah, definitely. I really dig this. I think this is the reason why, you know, Jason Blum is so ever-present is because he knows how to find the great haunted house movies. Like, this is right within his wheelhouse. This is the same, you know, Insidious and The Conjuring and Oculus. Like, these are the things that I think Jason Blum looks for, and when he finds them, man, he finds them. Like, this
is
awesome.
He is quite good at developing these ideas that a lesser person would have made into just another direct-to-DVD type thing that falls on bad CG. And he knows how to use practical right. He knows how to, like you said, not fall back on just generic scares. Like I said, my problem here was ultimately just with the third act scripting. I thought that I started to lose some of the fear when I was, like, as a horror movie, like hardcore watcher, I was finally like, you know, I've already given up hope for these people, so I'm not as scared because there has to be a light at the window.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like there was one, so for me that didn't
You're
work.
You're a horror
well.
Nihilist, that's fine.
No, quite the opposite.
Yeah, the opposite.
I was gonna say, I'm the one, I want the light, I want to see there's some hope, and I felt like this got hopeless too fast, but it's still an extremely well done movie, and it certainly scared a fuck ton of people quite a bit. There were people coming out of this film actually shaking.
Dang.
So, yeah, I do definitely recommend this, but I also recommend that you keep listening to the other things on Highly Suspect Reviews and what's the name of your show, the sports show? Inside the Locker. That's it.
Jesus Christ.
I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot. Something had to give.
Try to be a little bit more patronizing.
The original gentleman. I'm not being patronizing. I genuinely forgot.
That's better.
Man, no. I understand you don't like sports, but you should at least like the sports show.
I knew it
on your website.
I knew it was called ITL.
Inside the Locker. Yes, thank you very much.
Noise and all our other shows, because this particular podcast and our coverage of South by Southwest, with the exception of the upcoming Simon Bear interview, is
over. Nothing is over except this.
Except this, it is. But that's everything. Thank you, Martin, for
coming
in to join us. Thank you, Richard, who is already gone, but I'm sure he feels his ears burning.
We can talk to him through the mirror.
We can.
Yeah.
Richard, we need another guy with a British accent. Come back to us. Anyway. Say goodnight, Gracie.
Goodnight, Gracie.
Goodnight, Gracie.